depression symptoms. One of the answers was, I can feel nothing at all. One of the other answers was, I feel down and sad. And a third answer described really anxiety symptoms. And worldwide, the average postpartum depression rate was 10%. Some of the factors that we found that were associated with higher rates of postpartum depression symptoms included being a first-time mom, being a young mom, and having twins. All of those were associated with higher rates of postpartum depression symptoms. The group that we found that had the highest rate, though, were moms who were over 40 and who had twins. And I thought that was interesting. I can imagine, you know, getting to age 40 and then suddenly becoming a mother of twins is a significant risk factor.
Is there anything that we can do, whether we're the partner of someone about to give birth or a woman about to give birth, that might ease the likelihood that our loved ones would go into postpartum depression?
Sure. So first of all, I think if you're a pregnant woman and you're not being screened, you should ask to be screened and talk about it with your doctor. I think the more doctors become aware that they should be screening, the better. Secondly, I think families need to think very carefully about how to best support women who are in the postpartum time period. And that includes protecting their sleep, making sure they're eating, and making sure they're not overwhelmed. And then finally, if a loved one is really concerned that a mom, a new mom, is depressed, then they need to be supportive and help them go get treatment. It is difficult sometimes to initiate treatment when you're depressed.
Well, Jennifer Payne, it's so helpful to hear you describe this. I think it's the kind of suffering a lot of people do very alone, and it's helpful to know there are things we can do.
Absolutely. I think people should know that they aren't alone, even if they feel alone, and that this is very treatable and they can be feeling much better. They just need to reach out and get help.
Jennifer Payne is a psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences professor at the University of Virginia. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason at Virginia Humanities. Chemotherapy is the best weapon we have at fighting cancer, but it's notoriously hard on the body and causes a number of side effects. Maxwell Hennings is studying one of the side effects called chemo brain. That's a mysterious ailment linked to cognitive decline in some patients who've undergone chemotherapy. Hennings is a neuropsychology professor at Longwood University. Max, tell me about chemo brain. What is it exactly? How do people feel?
Well, chemo brain is something that happens to people after they receive chemotherapy. Not everyone gets it. And basically, it's just someone who has trouble remembering things, focusing on things, multitasking, kind of the same way that they were able to before.
Is it permanent once you get it?
There definitely are some people who essentially I would, you know, classify them as having lifelong impairments. That's not common for everybody, but, you know, for this subset of individuals, we're talking, you know, 10 or more years post-chemotherapy treatment, still having these kind of persistent problems with memory, focus, attention.
What about chemotherapy drugs themselves? Do they all cause it, or have some been found in the literature not to?
You know, that's a complicated question. You know, I think my reading of the literature is that there are at least, you know, we're starting to see some drugs being particularly known for causing problems, but there's a lot of different drugs that are being used. There's a lot of drugs that are being used in combination in different regimens, different dosing. So it's a really complicated issue, and we just really don't know, you know, are there particularly problematic compounds? We're starting to see that, but it's not well established yet.
Any idea what proportion of the chemotherapy patient population gets it? Is it like half of all or just a much smaller fraction of it?
There are, you know, a lot of disputes about what are the exact numbers of folks. It depends kind of how you quantify that, right? What counts as a true impairment? How do I, you know, classify someone as having chemo brain? But I think most of the research points to about, you know, 17 to up to 34% of people who are getting these chemotherapy drugs to combat cancer falling into this group of long-term cognitive impairments following treatment.
And what have you read about how people are reporting their symptoms? And what is sort of the range of symptoms you've heard about?
It can range from someone just saying that they have a hard time kind of focusing in really high demand environments. So maybe you have a job like, you know, air traffic controller or something like that, where you have to focus on lots of things all at the same time and kind of keep track of lots of things going on. And someone who says, you know, I really can't do that anymore. You know, I can't sit there and guide these planes and keep track of all of this information at the same time. But in their normal lives, when they're not at work, having to do that kind of high cognitive load kind of task, that they don't have any problems. And then you have other people who say, you know, I park my car and I can't find it anymore. And I used to be able to do that. That used to be something that was really simple for me to, you know, navigate back to my car and remember these things. And I am completely forgetting how to do that.
Right. And are other people even more debilitated? Like it hurts or they can't think straight?
I'm sure you could find people who would say that they would not have wanted to get chemotherapy if they had known that this was going to be the repercussion of getting chemotherapy, that they would have sought out alternative treatment. But, you know, again, there's a lot of variability in terms of, you know, what people are actually complaining of. And even within that, you know, there's some people that have really profound problems, but they go away, right? And I think a lot of people would make the trade-off of being cancer-free if I can, you know, suffer through, you know, 6 months of chemo brain where I, you know, have trouble thinking, I have trouble focusing, but it goes away, versus people thinking about, well, if I were to survive this 10 years from now, I still can't do the job that I was doing before. You know, my life has fundamentally changed.
So do you think scientists, researchers, doctors basically are speculating that the chemo treatments, which are targeting cancer cells, are also killing off some sort of brain cell or brain neurons that somehow affect our memory and ability to think clearly? Is that the hypothesis?
Generally, yes. It can also be that you're just disrupting kind of the normal function too. So you don't have to necessarily be killing brain cells. You can just be altering kind of how your brain normally functions, disrupting that process. I mean, the fact that this is such a complicated phenomenon, it's probably not happening the same way in every individual. We've got lots of different drugs that have lots of different effects within the brain and the body in general. And there's probably some individual differences, you know, even talking about the immune system response, right? So you can, you know, you can look at how these drugs trigger someone's inflammatory response, and each individual is going to have a different inflammatory response. And that inflammatory response might be really severe in some individuals, and in other individuals, it's not going to be as bad. So there's going to be recovery from that.
You are using rodents in your lab to monitor memory loss from chemo. What are you trying to tease out from these experiments?
What I'm trying to do is focus on what particular chemo compounds, or, you know, even different dosing regimens of high dose versus low dose or combination doses of these drugs seem to be causing problems for these animals. And then if we find kind of a dose or a drug that caused the problem, going in and kind of looking at the brain tissue and trying to say, well, what's happening within this organ that leads to these problems in these animals? And we can do that in a variety of ways. We can look at lots of different cells. So, you know, we have a lot of tools that we can use in animal models that we can't use in humans. And that allows us to have kind of a really sophisticated way of kind of examining all these different cells and all these different things that are happening within the brain to try and find out, well, what's happening, at least in these animals, that might be a mechanism of damage within the brain or disruption within the brain, and then look for that same kind of phenomena in humans.
And so how do you set up experiments to monitor chemo brain induced in mice?
It's tough. Generally, what we're doing is we're kind of combining both behavioral tasks, where they can show us that they have either learned or remembered something that we've had them done previously. And the idea is that we're trying to find animals that struggle with a task where we show them something and they can't show us through their behavior that they've remembered the previous exposure to that.
After they've gotten chemotherapy.
Right, after they've gotten, and comparing that to animals that didn't get chemotherapy or got low-dose chemotherapy or didn't get that particular combination of chemotherapy.
So describe the experiment you do where you train mice to swim through a tank of water and land safely on a little platform.
Yeah, so that's called the Morris Water Maze. Essentially, it's a pool with water that's been, we've added a little bit of paint to it, so it's opaque. And there's a hidden platform that's, you know, a few centimeters underneath the water level. And it's relatively small. You can imagine a mouse doesn't take much, a platform much bigger than maybe the palm of your hand to be out of the water. And mice don't like being in water. So they're motivated to find a way to get out of the pool. So when we put the animal in the pool, their job is basically to swim around and try and escape the water. And during the initial kind of training phase of this task, they learn that there's a hidden platform. So either they find it by chance or they're guided to it. And through repeated exposure of this task, doing it a bunch of times, the animals basically learn, hey, there's a platform. I kind of know the rules of this game. And I'm going to go straight to that platform because I remember where it is.
And they get good at this.
Yes, they get very good at it. Compared to an animal, for instance, that has no memory of doing that task before or might have trouble remembering exactly where that platform is, you can see differences in the animal's performance.
And after you've administered some of these chemo doses, you can really see the struggle?
Yeah, I mean, there certainly are animals that seem to just not learn the task, or if they learn the task, meaning early on they can show us that they can get to the platform, if we then wait, you know, a couple of weeks and then we put them in that same task compared to an animal that didn't get chemotherapy drugs, they're performing like they don't remember doing this at all, right? They're swimming in circles, they can't find that platform.
And then later, have you looked at differences in before and after brain tissue and seen any differences there?
That's the part that we're still struggling on, right? Finding specific markers within the brain that help us to understand the behavioral problems that we were seeing in terms of learning and memory in these animals. We've seen some indications that there are, you know, certain cells that might be reduced in number than others. But again, it's a complicated phenomenon. And, you know, we don't have the perfect answer yet. We're still looking to try and say, well, what consistently, right, do we see in these animals that are having trouble, what's going on in their brains?
If you're a scientist or a drug maker trying to perfect a chemo regimen that wouldn't induce chemo brain, what do you think the gold standard would be? I mean, what do you think people who are trying to do this are aiming for?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, if we had a really good understanding of, you know, what's causing the phenomenon, obviously, again, that trade-off between short-term versus long-term, I think a lot of people would be willing to make the trade of, I'm going to take this chemotherapy combo, it's going to make me feel sick, I'm going to lose my hair, I'm not going to feel very good, I'm also going to have some, you know, memory and attention and focus problems, but those are going to wane in the next couple of months after I stop taking the chemotherapy drug. Many people are okay with that. If we can figure out what's causing these kind of persistent problems that we're seeing, you know, years later, if we can identify, oh, well, these particular compounds seem to be causing this at a higher frequency, well, then let's avoid them. Or alternatively, if we know what these drugs are doing, we can administer other supplemental compounds to try and protect or repair that damage that might be caused by these drugs. So, you know, again, it's a complicated problem, and knowing what's going on within the brain that causes these impairments is the first step to trying to correct some of these issues.
Have you given any thought to possible similarities between chemo brain and the brain fog that people with long COVID are saying they're experiencing?
Certainly. So that's something that I've been thinking about a lot recently, and thinking about that inflammatory response, what our immune systems are doing when they're exposed to these chemotherapy drugs, or in the case of COVID, the virus, and how that inflammatory response can be helpful or can hurt us. And I think that we kind of see that same phenomena, you know, a little bit different flavor, right, than chemotherapy drugs, but the same kind of issue where for a subset of individuals, not everyone who gets COVID is going to have long COVID. But for some, there seems to be this kind of profound kind of difference in the trajectory where they end up in terms of well, I have, you know, now cognitive problems, I have vascular problems, I have all kinds of health-related effects as a result of my one exposure to COVID, you know, months ago, right? And that's what we want to try and avoid in the chemotherapy literature as well, is try and figure out, well, what is it about that individual or their, you know, immune response that drives these kind of long-term problems?
It must be so exciting to be playing a part in this.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think, you know, I think we all know someone who's gone through a cancer diagnosis, and the fact that someone might survive a cancer diagnosis and then have to suffer these, you know, in some cases really debilitating quality of life issues for the rest of their lives is something that is really heartbreaking, right? Because dealing with cancer by itself is really stressful. So trying to figure out, you know, what are the particular ways that we can help these folks and avoid these kinds of problems is really kind of energizing. And it makes me feel like I'm doing something worthwhile when I'm doing this animal research.
Well, Maxwell Hennings, I'm grateful to you. Thank you for talking with me and with good reason.
Thanks for having me.
Maxwell Hennings is a neuropsychology professor at Longwood University. Many people are prescribed Prilosec and Prevacid to treat their heartburn, but what if those same drugs could fight cancer? Randall Reef is a chemistry professor at the University of Mary Washington. He says heartburn drugs may turn out to have the potential to revolutionize the way we treat certain cancers. Randy, what sort of heartburn drugs are you talking about? And what first gave you the idea that heartburn drugs might help with cancer?
So what was really exciting about this was actually a student project. And she discovered a paper back in 2004 that noted that this drug, omeprazole, which is the main ingredient in your Prilosec, and she found that this drug induced cell death in the cells that we were studying in our lab. And so my student wanted to see if we could use other drugs like Nexium and the prescription drug to do the same thing. So could they also interact with the cancer cells that we grow in our lab that we study?
And by interact, you want to know, could they kill cancer cells?
Absolutely, yes.
So most of us think of antacids as something that, you know, mops up the acid in our digestive system. But how do you see antacids as relating to cancer cells?
Many cancerous tumors are kind of overactive. So you can think of cancer as trying to grow all the time. And
right.
So what that does is that produces a lot of cell waste. And so they actually use these special proteins called proton pumps. These proton pumps basically pump their acidity out of the cell and into their surroundings. These proton pumps are actually what the antacid drugs are treating.
So the idea is that cancer cells rely on an acidic environment to multiply, and heartburn drugs reduce the acid, which conceivably, your theory is, chokes out the cancer.
Yes. So what it does is by these drugs interacting with those proton pumps, the cancer cells can't pump the acid out of themselves. And so that acid builds up and they die.
How did you set up that experiment and what did you find?
So we grow these cells in our lab. Basically, she would take her cell solution and she would divide it up into some tubes. And in each of the tubes, she would add the different drugs, and then she would add a special molecule that would allow us to see if we were getting the type of cell death that we wanted. And she would look at them every 6 hours for about 30 hours. And she would look for basically this type of cell death activity.
And what did you find?
So we found that at 30 hours, that one of the main enzymes is activated just as strongly as the chemotherapeutic drug doxorubicin, which is a chemotherapeutic that is known to kill cells via the same method. And so she compared it to that. And when she got done with her 30-hour pictures, she brought me the pictures into my office the next morning. She came running in at 9 a.m. with her pictures all pulled up on her laptop. She sat the laptop down and was like, "Dr. Reef, look, it looks this picture of with these proton pump inhibitors, the Prilosec and Nexium, they look exactly the same as our chemotherapeutic drug for this type of cell death.
So if the cells she's looking at through the microscope look like the cells that have been exposed to chemotherapy, were you finding, in fact, that it was killing cancer cells?
Yes, they were absolutely killing our cancer cells. Now, it's important to note that we are looking at one type of cancer. So we are looking at a lymphoma, right? So it's basically a blood cell cancer. You know, one of the great things about working on a project like this is the fact that undergraduate students gain the experience of growing cancer in a lab, and they're responsible for growing and maintaining those cells. And so one of the first challenges I always present my students with is can they actually maintain a cancer cell culture for a 4-week period, right? And so that means that they have to grow these cells, and they have to, for lack of a better word, feed them to keep them growing, and they have to not, you know, accidentally let them die. And one of the ways that we know that is we know by how the cells grow. And so my students, when they look at the cells under our microscope, they'll know if the cells are growing by how the cells look. These particular cells are basically really small spheres, right? So they're tiny microscopic spheres. And when they grow together. And they actually, as they mass, they actually stick together until you shake the tube. When you shake the tube, they'll fall apart. They'll fall away from each other and separate. But if you're really gentle with the tube, I tell my students to gently take the tube and put it on the microscope and look inside and see if you see clumps of these cells that kind of look like Dippin' Dots, or for a better example, maybe grapes with no vine. So they should be clumps of these spherical cells. It makes me think of Dippin' Dots every time I think of that wonderful ice cream.
How do you feed cancer cells in a tube to keep them growing?
Right. That is a fantastic question. I love that. So we call it feeding, but basically what happens is cancer cells in culture, so the way we're growing them in an incubator, they'll grow totally uncontrollably. They will literally consume all of the nutrients. And as long as they've got access to the nutrients they need, they will continue to reproduce. And so what my students have to do is my students have to change out the nutrient. And so what they actually do is they let the cells get very concentrated in, say, a 10 milliliter volume, so a small volume of a tube. They let the cells grow until they've consumed all the nutrients. And at that point, they'll take a small amount of that concentrated cell solution out, they'll put it in a brand new tube, and they'll add a fresh allotment of this special medium, this special solution that has all the nutrients they need. And so in that way, you can keep the cells growing effectively indefinitely.
Like friendship bread, huh?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. You keep it going.
If heartburn drugs prove effective in fighting some forms of cancer, how would that change the way we treat cancer? What would be the advantage for treating cancer with heartburn medication?
So it's more that these drugs are more likely to open a door. So I would call it like opening a door to potentially the treatment of the types of cancers that rely on creating an acidic environment around their tumor. It's a different weapon, if you will, potentially. Now, I will admit freely that the future of this project is likely going to rely on future chemists and pharmaceutical researchers modifying these types of drugs. These are the drugs that we have. There would be ways that other researchers could take these drugs and use them as a base, and they could modify them to make them probably better at actually killing specific cancer types. But that's beyond me. That is outside my skill set, my research.
That's fascinating. I mean, the students must love learning about this.
They do. They do. And they love taking it to their other classes. That's why how this project was started was so amazing. So when Ashley was working on a completely separate project for a class, and she just found the paper and was like, you know, Dr. Reeve, we could do this. Like, we can get this drug. We could buy it from our chemical suppliers, and we could test this in our lab. And I said, let's go for it. And that's super cool.
And, you know, it's a reminder that innovation in science comes from every conceivable direction, right? It's not just a few top minds that are having breakthrough thoughts.
Correct. You got it. And that's, again, that's why I love doing this job. I love this job. I love watching the students figure out, find something new, find something that they're passionate about and pursue it. And getting to be a part of that and getting to do this research and take a come up with a whole new research project that is now recruiting students into my lab. And I've got students coming to Mary Washington that are working with me. It's been an absolute highlight of my career so far.
Well, it's really exciting to hear about. Randall Reif, thank you for talking with me and With Good Reason.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Randall Reif is a chemistry professor at the University of Mary Washington. Support for With Good Reason is provided by the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Cassandra Deering and Aviva Costo are interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and KBOO.FM on the web. It's 9:59. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your